All right, I'm sure you've heard your WGN faves talk about the great studios here on Wacker Drive. You can look up and out to Lake Michigan or right down the Chicago River. Now the river with the river walk that takes you up and down from restaurants to shops to great views along the banks of the famed waterway. But for all the people enjoying the Chicago River, even in the cold of January, chances are many of them have never heard of the Eastland.
It was the blue-collar Titanic.
Safety was just utterly disregarded.
The owners knew that they had an unstable ship.
844 bodies?
There was no iceberg, no torpedo. Someone surely did something wrong, and yet somehow...
graft, corruption.
It's Chicago, you know. Somebody got paid.
The story of the Eastland disaster and its aftermath is told in the new documentary Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day. It aired this summer. It's now airing again on Channel 11 this Thursday at 8 p.m. Harvey Moshman is one of the producers of the film. Harvey is Chicago TV royalty. He is a producer over at CBS and, of course, Wild Chicago. Harvey, good to see you.
Great to be here.
And Chuck Coppola is on the line, the other producer of the film, who is in Los Angeles. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening. All right, so let's get right into this conversation, because as I said, a lot of people who may be visiting Chicago or enjoying the new Riverwalk and the Chicago River may have no concept of the Eastland disaster. People who live here know it. Why take this project up? Why tell this story?
Well, I disagree with you. People here don't know it, and that was one of the inciting incidents of why we did this film. In 2001, I was a staff producer at TTW, and Chuck and I did this film mostly because few people around WTTW even knew about it, so we knew we had a good story. And then 18 years later, we got the go-ahead from the Chicago Marine Heritage Society to take another stab at it. And in the interim, there had been the film that was found in 2015. There was three books written about it, and we were funded. Those were the
that's the big thing.
Three reasons.
Chuck, why the interest in the Eastland? This is obviously a Chicago story through and through, but what was it about this project that interested you?
For me as a longtime news reporter, it's the tragedy of desperate ship owners who thought only of themselves and cost the lives of hundreds of innocent women and children. I mean, this is like this documentary is more than just an expanded news story. We look into the why and the how behind everything. And afterwards, you know, those responsible were able to manipulate the legal system for their own means and no one else's. The laws have since changed, so it can't happen again the same way it happened in 1915. But this is a story about ship owners who made a terrible error in judgment to risk everything for their own gain. And as the Eastland historian and author Mike McCarthy, one of the people we interviewed, told us, they then lied about it in court. Hmm.
Let's talk about this day, this fateful day in July 1915. Harvey, for people who don't know the story, give us the quick summary of what happened on this day.
All right. So Western Electric, which is one of the largest employers in the city at that time, it was the equivalent of the Silicon Valley of its day. So if you can imagine a picnic for Facebook employees or Google employees. All right, so 7,000 employees and their families are heading to the docks one Saturday morning. It's kind of drizzly, and the first ship to board was the Eastland. They loaded 2,500 or more, we don't know for sure, on the Eastland, and before it even left the dock, it turned over. It was still tied to the dock, and it turned over. It killed 844 in about 10 minutes.
And that story is told from generation to generation. My family is told that everybody went to one side of the boat, and that's why it tipped over. And that's the anecdotal story, referencing the documentary and everything, but the idea was that everyone got on, they said, oh, look, they were looking at someone in the water, and everybody went to one side, and it couldn't be stopped.
If you know anything about the Eastland, that's the thing you know, and it's wrong. There were so many people packed on board, there wasn't a possibility of moving to one side. A lot of the people were actually below because it was drizzly, so it wasn't a question of moving to one side. That was a story, a rumor started by the company to lay the blame on the passengers.
Chuck, isn't that amazing? That's amazing to think about. I'm talking from generation to generation, just being handed down the stuff that the company wanted you to hear.
you will learn more about the Eastland, even if you had heard about it. If you're one of the few Chicagoans who knew the story and think, oh, I've heard that, nope, it's different. There is so much more depth that we tried to bring to the public in this piece, and we're very grateful that for those who missed it this past summer when it ran, WTTW is running it again this Thursday at 8. We're very grateful for that opportunity to correct the record, so to speak, in many people's minds.
Did you have to go against your own knowledge of the Eastland? But both of you. I mean, as I just said, I mean, that's something that I heard from my dad, who heard from his dad. Did you have to go against what every Chicagoan knew or didn't know about?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. In 2001, when we made the first one, we didn't know that last fact I just gave you. That was sort of in dispute. But because the internet is so different now than it was then, there's so much more information available. We had access to all kinds of newspapers around the country. We had access to museums and so forth. So there was a lot more information that we just plain didn't know, mostly about the trial and the corruption that happened there.
Okay, so let's go in chronological order here. So that day that 884 people lost their lives, when the ship capsizes into the Chicago River, and I'm not even sure that's the right word, but when it capsizes, what happens? I mean, I can't imagine if that happened today, what do the authorities do? What's the rescue situation like? What happens in this moment?
All right, well, I'll give you a little indication. Chuck, you jump in here. But imagine an entire ship just packed to the gills with passengers inside. All right, now you turn it on its side, and it floods with water. So you, as a passenger, if you're on the riverside, first of all, you're getting completely squished by everybody on top of you. Then you're being flooded. So if you were inside the boat, you suffocated. You didn't drown because you suffocated first. The people who were on the top deck and thrown into the water, they drowned. Now, most of them drowned because they just plain didn't know how to swim. Plus, they're wearing wool clothing, which was the fashion at the time, even for a summer picnic. And the weight of those clothes is very difficult to overcome when they're completely wet.
Chuck?
You know, there are also, you know, as in any disaster that would happen today, there are, you know, emergency first responders. They show up. The news teams will show up. But also, also as with any disaster, there are always heroes. There are always people who step up and come forth. And we have numerous human stories about those people from Chicago's past who we try to bring back and make real in people's minds. People like Reggie Bowles, a young teenager from the north side who raced down to the scene. Helen Reppa, a one-woman emergency medical response team who took charge dockside. Mm-hmm. And June Fujita, photographer for Chicago Evening Post, who took those iconic pictures that every Chicagoan can imagine. You can see it in your mind's eye. When you think of the Eastland disaster, you think of the image. It's probably a picture taken by June Fujita.
Wow. The documentary is called Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day. Two of the producers, Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola, join me. You guys go through great lengths to tell the stories of these heroes. Let's hear from the human frog. This is just a clip that's about 30 seconds or so from the film. Pete?
This was a young kid who was a rascal. He was in trouble all the time.
He wanted in on the action, and he was a good swimmer. So Reggie jumped on a motorcycle, raced down through the streets of Chicago. When he got down to the water, he dove into the river and started finding pathways into the ship to look for air pockets and look for survivors.
He spends much of that day diving in and just recovering bodies that have already expired.
And it was sometime around this point when people started calling him the human frog.
The human frog. Wow, that's amazing to hear these stories. You want to do one more? Let's do Helen's story real quick. Helen, here's, as Chuck just mentioned, another hero from that day.
People were struggling in the water, clustered so thickly that they literally covered the surface of the river. A few were swimming, the rest floundered about, clutching at anything they could reach, pulling each other down, and screaming. The screaming was the most horrible of all. Helen Reppa.
Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola with me. The documentary on the Eastland disaster is on Thursday night at 8 p.m. on Channel 11 WTTW. Harvey, the story, though, because you're right, a lot of people have not heard of the Eastland, but let's say we have. Even people who have, and I've heard of it, I was surprised by some of the stories that came out that are not necessarily similar to what we know today when it comes to what happens during disasters or what the aftermath from the disasters. But I was surprised by the fact that no one was ever held responsible. And we'll get to that about the trial and everything that went into it. But also just this idea that, you know, it's quite possible that the class and the idea that this was immigrant population also plays into why nobody was punished.
Well, the reason it's so little known is probably because there's no one famous on board, except for George House. I don't think there's anybody in the on the manifest that anybody would recognize. As far as first responders, I mean, 844 people in the middle of the river today would be very difficult to handle, and they just clearly weren't prepared for that. But worse, in the aftermath, now this is July, and it's a hot summer in Chicago. And there is no embalming going on, and those that are embalmed can wait a little bit. But what happened was there were 700 funerals on one day, and there weren't enough caskets in Chicago for that. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, how do you prepare for that? It's just, that would be impossible.
Chuck, we're going to get into the trial stuff and what happened, but yeah, do you agree with the sentiment that because no one was famous and because this was an immigrant population that was on this boat, that maybe that has to, a little bit to do with why this isn't a much wider known story?
Well, the immigrants, you know, like many immigrants to America, in those first few years in a new country, you don't have the money or the time to fight legal battles like this. So they were pretty much on their own, and they didn't have the high-powered defense team, which they were battling, which in this case, interestingly enough, talk about blasts from the past, Clarence Darrow, who became later famous for representing the underdog in America, he was on the side of the defense in this case. So you have that. But there's another aspect of this is, you know, the embarrassing silence, some will call it, that why this is not talked about. It fell over the Eastland disaster for generations of Chicagoans, and it wasn't even talked about publicly at people who worked at Western Electric in the years that followed. And for decades, it wasn't even memorialized as an event that should never have happened in the first place. It was a very embarrassing tragedy for the city of Chicago.
That's well said. And let's do this. Let's take a break here. And when I come back, let's talk about how this went down after this huge tragedy where 844 people were killed. What happened? Who was on the hook? General Western Electric, everyone that was involved, and how, at the end of the day, no one was really punished for this. In studio, Harvey Moshman, also on the line, Chuck Coppola. The documentary is going to air on Thursday. It's called Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day. It's going to be on Channel 11 this Thursday at 8 p.m. It's Justin Kaufman. It's 720 WGN. Stay with us. 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman with you. Harvey Moshman is here. Chuck Coppola is on the line. We're talking about the documentary Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, which is about the Eastland disaster in 1915, where the SS Eastland capsized in the Chicago River, 844 people perished. And it's a story that I would say it didn't get a lot of play outside of Chicago. And in Chicago, a lot of generations know very little about this story. And we talked about right before the break why, because there seemed to be a hush campaign. Western Electric and others just don't really want to bring up, and even the Chicago leaders at that time didn't want to do commemorations or, you know, every year we talk about it and sort of remember and relive this tragedy.
Well, the interesting thing is not that it didn't play beyond Chicago. Newspapers all over the country covered it, newspapers in Australia and Canada. We have records of all that. But the interesting thing that we didn't know in 2001 was about the newsreels. All right, so there were three newsreel companies here in Chicago in the teens. You know, there was a pretty booming silent film industry at the time, and there were cameramen here, and they shot this. And the newsreels, although only 2 minutes of that survive of the hours of newsreels that were shot here, they were distributed all around the country, but not in Chicago. The city fathers of Chicago would not let it be seen here.
What? That's crazy.
Well, it depends on who you believe. It could be because they didn't want to embarrass Western Electric. It could be because it was just terrible. I mean, you're seeing bodies pulled out of the water. It was frightening.
Censored for that.
Right.
Western Electric, Chuck, what happens right after this? Do the authorities get involved? Does Western Electric get arrested? What happens after the Eastland disaster?
Well, dockside, you have a near riot starting when the ship's captain tries to stop welders from cutting holes in the ship to rescue people trapped inside. So they whisk him off to jail for his own protection. And then members of the crew are arrested also. And then there are seven investigations start. Everybody wants a piece of who is responsible for this at the outset. It goes from the police department all the way up to the U.S. Commerce Department. In the end, federal judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was in the federal judge here in Chicago during that time, basically bigfooted everybody. He stopped all the other investigations, all the other competing investigations cold, and he went with his grand jury investigation, and based on their findings, that grand jury's findings, he came up with the charge to charge the defendants with conspiracy to operate an unsafe ship. Mm. Originally, it was a conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government, which is interesting because one of the defendants was a U.S. Commerce Department ship inspector named Robert Reed, which means, by definition, he would have been charged with conspiring against his own employer. That, to me, led some credibility to the charge that conspiracy was thought by someone, more than one person in this case.
It's interesting because at the end of the day, what you need to know, and it's talked about in the documentary, it's also if you read the books as well, the Eastland itself was a very controversial ship. It was not a ship that, or a vessel that ever had a perfect sterling, you know, track record. It had listed a couple of times. It was built poorly. There was something wrong with the design. They all knew this, and it went through inspection, and you have to ask the question, and you do, about whether or not this was the Chicago way, where an inspector sort of said, yeah, this thing is fine, even though it might not have been.
I don't know that they called it the Chicago way back then, but it certainly was. The ship had come from Lake Erie. It had been running to Cedar Point and out of Cleveland and so forth, and there were three near capsizings in its history before it came to Chicago. And the owners who bought the boat just before the year before the Eastland, the year before the capsizing, knew very well that it was an unstable ship. And yet they rolled the dice and thought that they could get away with it. The trial was held in Michigan. That's one of the reasons little was known about it, is because after this terrible calamity happens, off it goes to Michigan, and it's out of sight, out of mind. And it was months later that a decision was handed down by Judge Sessions, no relation to Jeff Sessions as far as we know. But he was a very pro-business judge, and that's one of the reasons.
Is there a thought, Chuck, that there was... this sort of, this is 1915, 1916, all this, these years, that there was a judge on the take, that there was inspectors on the take, that this was mobbed up in some way?
I didn't say it, but Bob Clifford is on our program saying something to that effect. He says that was a time when there was graft and corruption in the courts, and that it would not have been out of the realm of believability that some wink and a nod may have been done in exchange for some leniency in the defendant's direction. But I want to add one more thing to this, and that is, I'm trying to bring this story to today. Yes, there are immigrants involved. There are immigrants in America today who are involved in awful things, nothing so far as we know like the Eastland disaster, and heaven hope that there isn't something like that. But there is this question of regulators and their relationship with manufacturers. In this case, it was the regulators, the inspectors of the steamship, and either the people who built the steamship or the people who operated the steamship, the companies that did so. Think now about self-driving cars or commercial aviation inspectors. Those are real-life today examples of where the relationship between the government inspector and the manufacturer or operator need to be on the level with each other.
Yeah, I think FAA and Boeing is a good example.
So at the end of the day, the judge goes in Michigan and says, you know what, not guilty. And essentially, does everybody who's involved in this horrific, one of the deadliest days in Chicago history, 844 people, everyone walks away hands clean?
Yes.
You got to be kidding me, man.
There was a chance that the state of Illinois would have picked up the ball and run with it and maybe file charges. For whatever reason, we cannot interview McClay Hoyne, state's attorney in Chicago at that time, But if I were to go back 100 years, you bet I'd ask that question. How come you never pressed charges? How come you never filed anything against any of them? Those charges were dropped. Those files were dropped. And the belief is that if they couldn't force the defendants to come to Chicago to stand trial, what chance did the state of Illinois have to get them to come back to Chicago for trial?
There was no extradition law at that time. So the first thing the owners did was they got out of Dodge. They went to their homes in Michigan and said, we're staying here. Hmm. So there are instances where people were kidnapped and brought back to stand trial in Chicago and other places. That did not happen here, but it could have. Nonetheless, all the owners beat it to Michigan.
It's an amazing story, and it's one of significance in Chicago history. Does it play outside of Chicago? Does this story have legs? Do people who live in California or in Germany or whatever want to hear about the Eastland? Do they find this as just deplorable as we do here?
Well, I'll say that there's a lot of Eastern European interest in the story. Beyond Chicago, people have never heard of it. I'm about to test the waters with that next week, looking for a foreign distributor. But it's kind of a universal. I mean, it is the shipwreck that shook America, and we hope that people will be interested.
Yeah. We are definitely trying to get a wider distribution throughout the U.S. and, as Harvey mentioned, across to other countries as well. Interestingly enough, one of the people who participated in the documentary, who's interviewed, found out about it while she was in Ireland doing research on her own family's history through Ancestry.com. Mm. And there is, as you know, this renewed effort to find out, who are my relatives and where did they live, what did they do. And it's through that connection that we're finding more people who are connected to the Eastland and in turn may be interested in watching a program about the Eastland.
Yeah. Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, is going to be on Channel 11, WTTW, coming up on Thursday at 8 o'clock. Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola, the guys behind the documentary. Good luck with the distribution. And thank you for doing this story and updating the story so Chicagoans can get a better understanding of their history. Thanks for being here tonight, guys.
You bet.
Thanks, Justin.